It is Thursday, April 18th. I'm here again with Danny Moses for his second
back-to-back market calls.
A market call right here. And Carter Braxton Worth,
right,
in the house. Now, this is a special reunion here, people. Okay, so Guy Dimey's not here. He's going to be back. Don't worry about it on Monday. Hopefully, we've kind of held the fort, if you will. But Guy and Danny, I think if you listen to the On the Tape podcast, you know this. They go way back, back in Danny's Big Short days. Carter, you used to find yourself in the Front Point offices. You knew Porter. You knew Vinny. Steve,
we had a lot of
obviously Danny. So what went on in those?
So here's what would go on.
Yeah, I want to hear a little bit.
We would have stocks, and we actually wouldn't even tell him beforehand. We wouldn't give him homework.
Why would
they? Right. Yeah, we would know. We want his spontaneous.
By the way, he doesn't know what we're going to talk about today.
That's right. So, even better.
So same thing.
Yeah. So we had a list of longs and shorts, and we would bring them up. We obviously had confirmation bias on our end. So we bring up like
fundamentals, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But we'd bring up like a short. Carter would say, a pair of twos. But I'm like, Carter, but it looks bad, right? He goes, potential bearish to bullish reverse. I'm like, are you sure? Because it does. So he would give objective. We would be subjective, but we would battle. And I would tell you that I would say 8 or 9 times out of 10 that he was correct. Yeah, and that it actually made us, you know, around our portfolio from time.
We would do it rapid fire. So it's just like chart. And then I would just give an appraisal.
Right.
But the person that probably broke the rules the most was Danny, because he would always say, are you sure? Or the next one's come up and you go, sell before it was up.
Right. How about this stock? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so anyway.
You know what that's a good example of, though, and you hear Carter say it on CNBC. He says it on our pods here. He calls them the fundamentals. And you've talked about how you started out in the business and you're a fundamental analyst and you did macro research and the like. Yeah. You know, for lots of folks like Danny and I who came up as fundamental analysts, you were an analyst. I was a trader. That sort of thing. Our job was to kind of know what the companies do, who their competitors are, right?
Sure.
What the important metrics are, how the macro affects, that was our job. But Danny and I always use technicals as a very important input, right? We didn't lead with it. And that's one of the reasons why I think we like to smash it all together here on the market call. All right, let's get to the rundown here. We got a lot of stuff to go through. And put your questions in the chat, because we're going to try to take them if we have time at the end of the program. Carter's here. Want to get Danny's take on the broad market, but we also want to chart the S&P and the NASDAQ 100 via the QQQ. Yesterday, we spent some time talking about the chips. It was ASML and ARM were getting hit really hard. Some good news out of some big names that have had huge moves over the last, call it 6 months or so, that are down on positive news. So that's a really interesting setup, I think, in the semis as we get into earnings. And then we're going to take a look at Netflix after the close today, Procter pre-opening tomorrow. And then if it's Thursday, it's Butters. That would be John Butters, senior earnings insight analyst over there at FactSet. And he's got some really good stuff for us today. So I'm excited about that. Stick around for that. All right, guys. Carter, let's talk about the S&P 500 here. My chart, not yours. I threw it up. Pretty simple 5-year chart here. A 200-day moving average. It's rising to that breakout level, right, mm-hmm. from a few months ago. It's 4,800 or so. If we go from 4,250 back to 4,800, you people can do the math on that, right? It's nearly 500 points. It's a little less than 10% or so. By the time it gets there, might that 200-day moving average be at that breakout level? And would that be an important support level in your mind?
Right. So obviously a prior high from which you break out becomes a reference point if you go back to it. So a check back to that level would be about a 10% decline for the S&P. And that would leave you to some extent corrected. The question is there a lot of support? That's just one reference. There's not a lot of stock, so to speak, changed hands there. And support is not a plywood board. Mm-hmm. It's not like that is a concrete floor that great. It's a mattress top. You sink to support and then often into support. Mm-hmm. So I would think that the current sell-off doesn't, first, I do think it continues, and I don't think it will stop at that green line. I think it'll dip further into support.
So quick question, and that's a great point. So that prior high from last July, right, that was like 4,600. Right. So would you say, and this is really, I think, for a lot of folks at home who are trying to figure this out, just like, let's say we are. So if you were to get through that 4,800, like you said, not a lot of stock changed hand, that 200-day moving average is a reference point that a lot of folks kind of look at. So if you were to move between 4,800 and 4,600, would that be a good support range?
You'd be in well into support at that point, right? And that point, you'd be down about 12%, and that would be a much more mature correction. This thing is only seven sessions old. We're down 4.9%.
And you would not, depending upon what you saw in the sectors and the individual leadership, you would not be pressing though down at 4,600.
No, probably. I think that's at that point, and that's what that becomes. That's what a pair of twos is. So you have something that's steep and uncorrected that then does draw down 12%. Pressing shorts there is risky, can bounce on you, or just buying because it should bounce, but it doesn't is risky. That's where you just, then you stand aside and you say, all right, let's watch this thing and see how it behaves. And then if it backs and fills and then weakens again, then you know you've got yourself.
Yeah. And so Danny, I mean, like, you know, listen, you know, one of the things we get tagged a lot, you know, you, myself, Guy, I know what you're saying. We get tagged as like these perma bears, you know, just because you've been wrong on the S&P 500, I've been wrong on the S&P 500. You've gotten gold, right? You've gotten oil, right? You've got a lot of sectors, right? That sort of thing. How do you look at a chart like that? When you see that, is that important to your process? Like, do you have to start with the S&P 500 before you can make some sort of assessment on individual, you know, names or sectors?
I think in this case, with how top weighted the S&P 500 has become, you get the, you know, large move up and potentially large move down as a result of just two or three names that may fall by the wayside. So I think using this as a tool, but then using maybe the top two or three names and doing some type of fundamental work on them, understanding that risk. Carter's known for the 150 day.
Yep.
So I don't know if we can bring that up, but I would also want to see the equal weight S&P to kind of
pull
take
up the RSP
out.
Then. Let's that with 150 day. They can pull that.
Wow, we can do both in one shot.
Yeah, no, they're not going to overlay it, but again, so we just have our fact set machine set to the 200 day. So I Carter's work, he's going to look at his. Always using the 150.
Yeah, Carter, can you explain again to the viewers why you use 150 other than Spinal Tap?
Yeah, exactly. It's a big subject, and one day we'll cover it in its entirety. But the default on every computer is the 200 day. And when you ask people, and you're talking about big people, huge pension plan managers, well, why do you use the 150? After they've asked, why do you use the 200? Yeah. They ask me 150, and I say, well, before I answer, why do you use the 200? In 32 years, I've gotten three answers. The first is, well, that's the number of trading days and some weird, Okay. Second, that's what was on my computer. What, you just sat down and started driving the car because that's what was there on your Bloomberg or William O'Neill had it? And the third is, you know what? I just don't know. Okay. So you have to do some work on some things. We did a lot of work at DLJ and my teacher and mentor started in the Fidelity chart room in the 1960s. Basically introduced this to me. And if you do some tests on it, you will find that the hit rate for the 150 day, which is tied more to the quarterly earnings cycle than 200, its efficacy is higher. But anyone who wants
to... Is it much higher or no?
It's meaningfully higher.
All right. So Amanda, take note. We're going to move to the 150 day so next week. All right.
Didn't patent that, did you? Did you have to pay your licensing fee anytime anyone brings up 150?
I love the fact... This sounds so Mad Men-esque. The fact that he said, my mentor, which was back in the 80s or early 90s, right? Well, started in the Fidelity chart room. Can you just imagine a bunch? And they used to call them like gnomes, right? The chart guys or something like
that. And I did it by hand because without a computer and something else.
It was like a drawing room or something
about
like that.
Think about moving averages. Without a computer, right? Well, how do you, there are no moving averages. Yeah. So, because you'd have to wait for the closing price today of Proctor, and then you'd have to add that to the 150 and then remove one from 150 days prior, add them all up, divide, and then plot the moving average. A moving average is a function of a computer. And so the original book writers really didn't use moving averages, they used trend lines. But it's a trend line. That's all the moving averages.
So really quickly, in 1997, when I was working at a hedge fund, the guy that I worked for, so I was his trader executing orders. And my job, when I got home at night, he got me a compact computer. Remember those things were like this wide, this and that. And I had a chart program. I think it was like called TradeStation or something. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Or a quote track or something like that. I can't remember. And I had to load up the list of stocks that was on his board. And he had like 10 screens. And I had to look for certain patterns, reversal patterns, breakout patterns, you know, all that sort of stuff. Every night, but I had to put it into an AOL dial-up, and I used to have to I had to download that day's tick. Sure. I mean, like that was it, and see what changed. All right, enough of that. QQQ, NASDAQ 100. Let's look at this one.
Did we do that? Brought it up. Ooh. Sorry, I think we were bringing up that equal weight.
Well, there you go.
They did all that work, and all right, Carter, opine on that one.
Right. Well, so the key here is it's down. Right. It was lagging, and then it's down now more than the S&P on this recent dip. And it too is not down to support. If we pull that back and go to the former high,
you'll see that, or something.
We're just back down into it, right? Here's another thing interesting. So we agree, and we can all see this visually, both the S&P and the equal weight S&P made new highs, right? Yeah. S&P adjusted for inflation is still below its 2021 peak.
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, we've had a lot of inflation, haven't
we? Yes, we have.
Right, let's look at the QQQ. This is immune to inflation. This is like the anti-inflation trade. This is Danny's gold trade here. Danny, let's talk about this a little bit, because in Butter's work, we're gonna talk about the concentration of these top names and really their contribution to earnings. And I think that's going to become the story really quickly, because again, rates going higher didn't bother tech stocks this time around. But when the Fed in late 21 into 22, when they signaled rates going higher and they actually started doing it in 22, we know what happens. You can just look from there. You know, you see that high, right, in late of 2021 and how far it went. So it's really interesting. Talk to me a little bit how you're thinking about yields, inflation, as it relates to, again, if you're looking at this, the top eight names make up 50% of the weight of this index of 100 stocks.
Yeah, well, there was a huge event. I mean, AI was a seminal event. Yeah. It was. And how long that lasts and what that means, we will see over time. I try to ignore that, like I said, a little bit. And you're right. If you have debt on your balance sheet, you need to pay attention to rates, right? If your clients that are buying your product need financing, you need to look at rates, right? So there are screens, yeah. Let's be clear, that Wall Street people run and individuals can run and say, all right, what is your exposure? What's your debt? So forth. And that's how you kind of come up with a list of names that you want to own. As you know, I don't love these ETFs in general. I know that's what people use, yeah. Right? But I like to look at the breakdown of it.
Why don't you love them?
Because
I love them. I trade them like crazy. Listen, I love trading options on them.
No, I'm not saying you can't use them as a trading tool. Yeah. But at the end of the day, if you want to express a theme, we've talked about this with the XLF, yeah. Right? The top 10 names are all so different. They're exposed to a different.
Well, that's a poorly constructed ETF.
But so is this in the sense of how
really
heavily weighted it is.
Can I tell you why I actually like this? And I'd love to get Carter's take on this. So if I think that I don't want the idiosyncratic risk of, let's say, Apple, but I like Amazon and I like Meta and I like Google and I like a few others, and then I love these like small or like you know, these $10 billion or $15 billion like SaaS names that I know were in here and this and there, whatever. The QQQ is perfect, right? So think about this year. I mean, Apple is down, you know, 12% on the year, while, you know, Nvidia, which is a huge component, is up 70%, and, you know, Google's up 12%, and Amazon's up 20% or whatever. Like, I have all the exposure that's actually, like, it's dispersed amongst a lot of names. And then if there's a stock that becomes the next Nvidia going from $200 billion to $2 trillion, you know, you're going to benefit from that. That's, I don't know. Right. I like this ETF a lot, actually.
But talking about the concentration, because markets are always concentrated, right? And that is the nature of, and if you look back over the last 55 years, on average, the top 10 stocks are 20% weight.
Yeah.
But they're 30 plus now, right? So that's where we've got, because life is that way. The Home Depot comes in and the little hardware store fails, right? McDonald's comes in and the local burger joint fails. So that there's always bigger things at pushing out smaller things. We're always concentrated. Your drug doesn't work, mine, Lilly or Merck or Pfizer, I get bigger and you go out of business or I acquire you. So the concentration is a part of markets. And it's the definition of winners win and losers lose, however you want to interpret that. But we're so concentrated now at 30% plus versus 20 that then becomes both a positive. If it's a virtuous cycle, it keeps going, then they hold the market up. But if there's trouble, like ASML is having some trouble, and you've talked that maybe some of these will miss on their earnings, then it goes the other way. You get the benefits in reverse.
Well, all right. So this is where I think the pitfalls in 2024 lie. Okay, Danny. So let's just do this right now. If it's Thursday, we go over John Butters. He's the senior earnings. It's like Butters. And you know where to get this. You go, look, there it is. Insight.factset.com/subscribe. You can have the Earnings Insight blog in your email box. You can have it on Friday morning. We get a preview of it on Thursday for Market Call. So this is a good segue from what we were just talking about. So what John's focused on right now is of the top six positive contributors year-over-year earnings growth for the S&P 500, we know what they are. Okay. Five are Magnificent Seven companies. Overall, the blended actual plus estimates earnings growth rate for the entire S&P 500 is 1.3% for Q1 2024. Nvidia, Amazon, Meta, Google, and Microsoft combined are projected to report earnings growth of 63.7% for Q1 2024. There's your secular shift, okay?
Yeah.
The blended earnings decline for the other 495 companies in the S&P is 5.1% for Q1. Danny, talk to me about that. This is the risk right here. It's not on the charts. It's not on this. It's basically if you have the sort of deceleration or negative guide or lack of visibility, this is the fact that's going to take the S&P.
Yeah, there's five names. I don't know why they're still using Magnificent Seven. We'll come to that another time. There's really five. And you name the five there below. This is why I think single stock picking is better than getting either drawn down by the rest that are bringing down the rest of the group, right? A risk. Pick one of those two. Yeah,
but that's the risk though, Danny. If you get Meta wrong, let's just say they put up a gangbuster Q1, but they guide down for Q2, that stock's going to be down 10% like that.
But it's going to drag, right? But it will drag down obviously several other components. And because it's self-fulfilling that the ETF sell off, it's math, and people are, you know, in the passive market sell, everything goes down proportionally. What I'm saying is those are opportunities to names that get hit for no reason that are in that ETF, whether it's Qs or SPYs, whatever, gives you the opportunity to buy. And I want to say one other thing that just for people out there, I think it's very topical to understand this. The drive into passive investing that we've seen, right? Obviously, it's been evident for years. I think really started when retail brokers, stopped getting paid on commission. They became asset gatherers and charge a management fee. So I'm just saying they became lazy. Mm-hmm. They just changed the way that they do business. Therefore, I go back to the art of stock picking single names. You need to be aware when you're in these ETFs. I just beg people to look at something. I'm not saying that's not the easiest, cheapest way to express a theme. Yep. And you always get, but all I'm saying is understand what's driving it, the reason driving, go all the way back. I know brokers that still stock pick.
Right. And there are very few because the houses don't want it. The big wire houses, we don't want these gunslingers. You're just blowing up people. We get sued.
Well, they want to push them in their products.
They want to be on the platform.
And the beauty of it is when you have to convince someone to put on a trade, you've got to get them on the phone versus, hey, every month you send me a little money and I just put it into the ETF and it's all this virtuous cycle. But at some point that becomes there's a British expression, too clever by half. Yeah. And all of a sudden things can go very wrong as people pull away.
Let me answer your question though, Dan, because go back to your question about the quality of the earnings growth, right? Those companies, those big companies that are in a secular growth area, they've done an amazing job. Let's think, they've been cutting jobs now for a year. They've already been 3 years. They've been lean, right? They've been leaner. And there's no question from an enterprise spending perspective that if we do go into recession, they're going to get whacked because there's still too much of their businesses that still depend on that. Yes, they've had this growth. So again, take it all. You got to look at so many different factors.
Well, think about Tesla. I mean, they just cut 10% of their workforce, 14,000 people. The stock went down. Usually, Meta rallied on that 2 years ago.
17 minutes before Tesla. I'm in awe.
Geeked up. All right. But this is actually, to me, the more important part about Butter's work this week. And this is looking out to Q4 2024. So you remember the days of like the back half loaded or, that sort of thing. Yep. And every time we'd hear an analyst or a strategist kind of talk about that, you really want to discount that. So let's look at Q4 2024. Analysts expect double digit earnings growth for the other 495 companies in the S&P 500. Okay. So let's just be clear. We just said the other 495 are supposed to be down in Q1, right? 5%. Overall, the estimated earnings growth rate for the entire S&P 500 for Q4 2024 is 17.6%. NVIDIA, Amazon, Meta, Google, and Microsoft combined are projected to report earnings growth of 19.8%. The estimated earnings growth rate for the other 495 companies in the S&P 500 is 17.2% for Q4 2024. So they're basically saying we are going to see the other companies catch up in growth rate terms. That means the economy is inflecting. That's the only way. The global economy is getting better. It means commodity prices are coming down. The U.S. dollar is coming down and that rates are coming down. All of those things pretty much have to come in line, Carter, to get to where consensus is.
Historically, if you look at analysts start out the year and they basically revise their numbers down about 1% a month. Mm-hmm. Remember, it is called the sell side for a reason. Yeah. They are selling securities, right? Yeah. And so their price targets are always high. And then typically they have to adjust or look at it this way. There are 500 stocks in the S&P. The average one is covered by 20 analysts. So that's 10,000 ratings. Do you know how many are sell? 4%.
I was going to say 500.
It's about 35-40 or buy and hold split. And the difference, what it is that hold is the euphemism for sell because they cannot say sell. Because when you say sell, then the IR department gets angry. The bankers say, what are you doing? We're trying to do a deal. You put it as a sell. And so they just give this quiet hold, even though their price target is way below. It's all a bit of a
fugazi.
Oh,
there you go. There's the word.
It's all part of the plan.
All right. Well, listen, you know where to get John's work. We find it very valuable. We love getting a preview of it on Thursdays. And I can't think of a better time to kind of dig into it. And as we get into earnings season here, let's talk about some single names that let's hit a couple names that report reported this week. And again, we know we got kicked off with a lot of the financials. And I thought one name kind of struck me a little bit here. It was Wells Fargo. Have you looked at this one, Carter, today? It's making a new 52-week high. Okay. So again, reported last Friday on a day that JP Morgan was down 6.5% after its own earnings. Wells Fargo, you know, didn't get hit that hard. I think people thought the results were pretty decent. So thoughts on this one. I pulled it out. Let's do three charts here. I have a 5-year, and you see we're basically almost back to that 2021 high, Carter. And then if you look at this longer term, a 10-year, you see a little bit of this downtrend that we're just breaking here. Those three charts, my charts, not yours. What do they say to you?
Well, in the first instance, of course, we've returned to a prior reference point, and we are backing and filling. Only a slight new high today. The here and now chart is what's sort of that tight trading and consolidating, and then just ever so slightly punching higher. My own thought is this doesn't have a lot of room to run, despite its decent day today. It has appreciated a lot since its October low, along with all banks. And my hunch is to fade this, to at least sell calls or take some profits. Because the thing about breaking out from a tight range like that, if it was definitive, it would be a gap, it would be higher. It's eking out a slight new high versus a definitive.
Yeah. And just a little shout out here, Denny, you brought this up before we went on. Dickie Betts of the Allman Brothers passed today. Very sad.
Yeah, 80 years old.
Yeah. Amazing.
Pretty good 80 years, though.
Yeah. Man. So again, and we were saying no one left to run with. That was his baby, wasn't it?
Yes,
a little bit.
Exactly.
Thoughts, Danny, like if we didn't really hit him yesterday, what was your take on some of the money centers versus the investment banking? Like what that you saw in earnings over the last
year? Yeah. Some were priced to perfection.
Yeah.
JP Morgan and some weren't. Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
All have different issues. You can see that their loan growth is anemic in many areas because of private credit continues to take market share. I thought credit in general, with the exception of some pockets in Bank of America, seemed to still be okay. So there's nothing really to worry about. But I think they're just, you know, utility stocks.
Let's pull the BKX up for a second here. Let's do a 1-year. So you basically, again, there's nothing to get too excited about, but part of the story is JP Morgan was making new all-time highs seemingly every day for a month, was that, you know, there's new leadership here. It's back. That was a $500 billion market cap company, and some of those other money centers were coming back. You saw that how Morgan and Goldman reacted to their earnings and the like here. Carter, what does this BKX look to you? You had the breakout after that consolidation, and we got this little bit of a pullback. Is this something you want to buy?
No, I mean, it's a pullback into support, but it's a minor range from which it broke out, right? So not a whole lot of support. And then, of course, there's the juxtaposition with the KRE, and that's down to and even through its moving average. I don't know whether that's 200 or 100, doesn't matter, but take a look. So that is sloppy. Now, Danny, what you're saying, there's always those sort of high quality super regionals like PNC and US Bancorp.
M&T.
M&T. How are those? Do you see though? Are you expecting those to be names they are or no?
I think within the regionals, you have high quality and low, mid and low quality. I think the argument to own the big banks is that if you believe that commercial real estate is still on the decline, you can avoid that on a percentage basis of balance sheet by owning the big ones.
They still have plenty of exposure,
but remember how accretive these small banks can be to the bigger banks, and we know who's going to win. The other piece in all of this is, let's be very clear, that if the shit hits the fan, can I say that on live?
You just did.
It's
fine.
That we know that the banks are overcapitalized, the large banks. They have very strict ratios that they've been adhering to, right? They've been adhering to. And if treasuries become... they just run amok and yields.
Right.
We know that the Fed and Treasury need these big banks to be a buffer.
Right.
So I think the other thing happening potentially is that they are kind of the savior, so to speak. So again, you're looking within the KRE, again, bad ETF, bad in the sense of you could make a portfolio long and short out of that thing, right? To what the themes that you want to express. But again, I think it goes back to, why am I messing with these? You want to mess with them when they're 0.6 times book. You want to maybe buy the hell out of them, right? But anyway.
So. All right, let's go to another thing here. And we've had a little debate, I think, a couple days ago on yields. Let's pull up the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, because, again, you know, you would have thought that the banks, especially the money centers that had all those issues as it relates to their held-to-maturity mark-to-market portfolios, we saw it in Bank of America. I think their mark-to-market losses were over $100 billion. You know what I mean? It was not a small number here. Carter's been making the case that higher for longer. You've said it on this show. You've said it on Fast Money. You know, look at that. That's a 2-year. We're basically, you know, right in there. I think you've even talked about the average over the last few years has been 4.1% or something like that. This is a really interesting chart. I just wanted to throw this in front of you. This is like a 40-year log chart of the 10-year yield. And you see that like downtrend, right? And you see like just what's happened here. And we know it's a pretty unique situation on the backside of COVID or so. If you're playing for lower yields, Carter, do you think we get as far as a like a retest of that downtrend, which would put you down at like 3% or so? We're 4.64 right now.
Wasn't that two on that?
Well, it gets below. Yeah.
I don't think that's
2.75 or something like that.
Good old days.
I guess I would say it this way. If we go back to the here and now chart of yields, there's two ways to interpret this. One could say we've just moved up 100 basis points from basically 3.7 to 4.7 in the past 4 or 5 months. We have 100 basis points. But one could also say where the green line starts in October of 2022, which was the low for the S&P, that was 4.35, and here we are at 4.65. We're up 30 basis points in 18 months. Is that higher? And so both are fair interpretations. For the higher for longer mantra to be sort of accurate, real, true, and actual, we would have to go back above 5. So as long as we're sitting here muddling, I don't think it's either or. And then maybe end with this. I have a lot of clients who basically make the case, Carter, as long as it's 4.5 to 3.5, it's Goldilocks. It's the problem of going 3.25, 3.10, or going 5.10, 5.25. And as long as we stay here, who the hell cares?
Yeah. So you've had to deal with the Fed and Treasury manipulating these for a very long time.
Yep.
And you looked at that chart. We talked about it yesterday on Market Call. Dan, what's a normal 10-year yield? It's higher. It's 5.6. It's 6%, right, over a period of time. So this normalization, right, and we know that we're still not done with Bunsen and Beaker in the lab messing around with with these rates, right? So again, we've survived for many years with higher rates than this. The question is, like, now we got so used in such a financialized leveraged economy, can we survive? It's just a different time. So this is going to play out over a very long period of time. QT, we're going to stop that for a little bit, maybe a little bit more than you think. So you have to deal with that. Again, the other reason that the large banks may be doing okay is because, again, they know that quantitative tightening is slowing.
Yep.
I wouldn't be surprised if we see QE in a year. But anyway, whole different episode. But so that's how I kind of look at that. It's just very hard because it's nothing to compare it to.
All right, let's focus on earnings here a little bit. So a name that reported this morning, we had the sales out from Taiwan Semi, I want to say about 2 weeks ago. They gave earnings and earnings guidance. And, you know, initially, I mean, I was actually just happened to be up. I don't know if you guys do this every once in a while. And it was like 2 a.m. and the results were coming out. I was watching it come across. It looked pretty good. And, you know, you wake up this morning, you know, after I went back to bed, I wake up at 6 a.m. and the stock in the pre-market is down 2%. I was like, what happened? Well, what happened is it's just there's a lot of good news in the stock. I mean, look at that breakout. That's the 1 year. Let's go to a 5 year here. I mean, this thing at one point, I think, Carter, was 30% above its moving average on that March 8th thing. That's just not the sort of thing that, you know, it seems sustainable. You look at that massive double top that we saw in 21 and 22 and, you know, how the stock pulled back here. Listen, the headline of the earnings was that this is the first earnings, a positive earnings print in a year. Okay. So this stock, just think about that, right? So when you think about the downturn that they saw away from AI, it was pretty massive here. And, you know, to me, this is not surprising. It's probably surprising to many folks who just think that this AI trade is just going to go to the moon. Carter, thoughts on the reaction to this? At one point, it was down 5% shortly after the opening. I think it's down 3.5-4% right now.
Right. So it's identical to ASML. Yeah. Right. So you have two big internationally prominent sort of tech related and semi and specific related names, both of which look like that.
Well, by the way, Taiwan Semi is a huge customer of ASML.
Right. So if we look at the two, now the question is, once a give back, check back, a sell off, a dip, a correction, a decline, a drop, a plunge, you can use your word. Once that starts, it's very hard to know where it will end. But surely it doesn't end here, right? This is day one of a gap, and you can annotate it as you've done it there and say, hey, perhaps it's that green line, or perhaps we're going to fill the gap that's below that. But the main thing is buy, sell, or hold at any given moment. And buying it here because it's just dipped a bit would be bad technique by my work.
I think one of the also keys to look at is volume weighted, you know, in terms of the volume that's been occurring while those charts. And I say that because most everybody, even at this level, is down money in this stock.
Yeah.
But I don't care where, because a lot of people that came on late. And the reason that charts work, Carter, my opinion, is human behavior and behavioral finance 101. I'm not selling it until it gets back till I'm break even, which is the dumbest thing in the history that you can do, because it's an opportunity cost. What if you sold it and just bought something else with it that you like? But that's why charts to me are useful. But I would tell you that even though the stocks, I don't know how far it is off its highs, I bet the majority of people that are in it are down in it, if that makes sense. Well, on the retail side, that's
maybe
they were chasing it. But I'm saying, think about the volumes that have been occurring on the run up versus the volumes that were occurring when it was kind
The point to anybody about anchoring, you see it in the real estate market. Someone puts their house on the market for $1.5 million or whatever it is, and then all of a sudden it's like moving it. Says, okay, lower to $1.4 million. When the bid, they've got someone who's, well, I'm giving you $1.3 million. I don't want to play $1.5 million. And they're like, how about $1.4 million? And all of a sudden, then that person's the only one. And they're anchored to that one. All of a sudden, the best offers are $990. You're like, but it's worth $1 million. It's not worth anything. It's worth what someone is willing to
pay. I want to make one point about Taiwan Semis. So the guidance that they gave, you know, at some point in 2 years, advanced AI chips are going to be 20% of their business. They own 90% of the market share, like of that market. Okay. But they have a lot of consumer exposure. You know who their largest customer is? Apple, 23%. And then it's Qualcomm at 9%. And then it's AMD. Let's throw up an AMD chart. This thing is this is horrible. I mean, like, it really is. It just broke 160.
I can't believe we're talking. It's crazy that 2 weeks ago we were talking about how great the charts were.
I'm
not saying, it's amazing how semis. I'm saying it's amazing how quickly.
I mean, look at this thing. This thing is going back to that breakout level, at least the 200-day moving
average. There, essentially. Right. And hard to know, like, do you take advantage of a 20%+ sell-off in a name like this that's back or getting close to support? Or do you say, wait a minute, something must be wrong that it's doing this?
Something was never right with this stock. If you go back to their Q4 earnings, I mean, I'm being serious. Like, it was
right there.
And we've gone back and forth in this idea of a sentiment bubble. You know what I mean? Clearly a sentiment bubble. Let's pull up the SMH for a second here. We have a chart. I mean, so again, you know, NVIDIA quickly became a huge part of this. I think it topped out at maybe 27% the weight of the SMH. And I say to my, look at that breakout. I mean, look at that breakout. You got to go back 25 years to see this performance on this sort of market cap, right? Like, you know what I mean? So I don't know where this thing comes back to, but it's not going higher before there's like, it gets overdone to the downside. Wouldn't that make some sense, Carter?
I mean, it has to be corrected. That's the point of that sort of concept. And this is not enough, this sell-off, to correct that very steep uncorrected advance of the preceding 6 months.
Yeah. Well, it'll be really interesting to see as we get into some of the other earnings. We know that NVIDIA is not going to be until late May. So you're going to get AMD. You're going to get Intel. Who cares? They're going to suck. You know what I mean? Qualcomm in the smartphone space is going to suck. You know what I mean? Like, so let's see, you know, what NVIDIA can do. But NVIDIA is going a whole heck of a lot of sideways right now. Before we get to the previews, we're going to preview Netflix and Procter. I just want to pull up Tesla. I know we've spent a lot of time on this one. Another downgrade today, Danny. Thoughts on like, it seems like all the Tesla folks on the Twitter are like eating themselves. Like they you know, all their former heroes are now their duds. Yeah. I'm hearing more and more from legitimate folks. This company could probably, if it's an auto company, could probably use a dedicated CEO who's just focused on manufacturing and the like. You know what I mean? That sort of thing. Just quick take here. We know that you've been very bearish of this name and right.
Fundamentally, Musk aside, autos are driving, the auto valuation is driving the stock right now. And that, why is that? Because there's nothing else right
now. Well, really, margins have come in line.
I'm saying there's nothing else to save it. And I think that the people's, you know, that are relying on Musk, you can't wait around anymore. People are growing impatient. And as a fundamental basis, we're not even close to where this thing could go.
Right.
He could try to pull some rabbits out of his hat, you know, with supervisory FSD. So that's an oxymoron, supervisory full. So I don't know what that
is. So they call it supervised FSD,
right?
Self-driving.
So supervised FSD. Right. So it's supervised now.
You have to have your hands on the wheel.
I would call that not autonomous.
Eyes open and hands on the wheel.
Exactly. And again, think about going back. We were walking up here with Carter. Walking upstairs, and I said, you know, you think about Tesla, 2018 with the fake 420 bid, it has split 15%. The stock's still over $2,200 on a relative basis to that 400. It's still up fivefold. So congratulations to everybody that's out there, but wake up right now. We keep talking about it on a fundamental basis. You have absolutely zero. Oh, robo taxi, that. Meanwhile, all the technology for all this autonomous driving is happening all around them. And guess what? It's not there. People leaving. When did I throw the flag? The red flag up was when Zach Kirkhorn left the company last August. Mm-hmm. That is my number one. I'm not Tesla related. Any CFO leaves a company. Right. Whoa. You know, in any really for unexplained 13 years. things were going to be so great in 2024. I didn't want to be around for it.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry. Now you got me going. 17 minutes. So bottom line is, I don't even, if we're in the office right now, Carter, and I ask you about that chart and you were to say pair of twos, which probably not true.
Not, no,
it might be over. And we used to have scotch in the office.
Yes,
and I would take
did.
Okay.
We always had scotch.
So what is your interpretation
it's
of that
just a,
particular?
A weak stock in an established downtrend that's likely to get weaker. The real question is when it approaches, if and as, that 100 low, does that become a reference point where it starts to find some buyers, or does it ultimately undercut that? At this rate of descent, were we to get down to 100, at that point I would play for a bounce because it would be a fairly mature and extreme sell-off over a 6-9 month basis. Breaking that 100, you start to get into something that's fatal.
So Carter, let's just talk about this. So when I was drawing this up, I just think that gap in January of, 2023 is pretty fascinating. So it went from 100 to 200 in a straight line in like 2 months or something like that.
That hurt.
It did hurt. And I think you and I both lost a lot of money, but we were convicted. That was also around the time that Elon tweeted at me that I was a doofus, by the way, okay, for whatever that's worth. It's rare that you see such an air pocket like that, a potential air. There is not a shred of technical support below 150. Is this fair until 100?
No, there is none. The question is, how quick, again, if and as we get to that low, and I think that's where we're going, right? Does the stock just work right through that? Or does it ultimately find a bit of support? My hunch is you'll see buyers step in, right or wrong, and that activity. Also, people who've been properly short, they started, wait a minute, it's 100 here. Maybe I should buy some in. That all represents the kind of thing that makes it stop at that reference point. But I think the first and primary interpretation is this stock is very likely headed to that 100.
There is a possibility that when they report next week, the setup, and you've called this every time for the last four quarters, correct? Yeah. It is a disaster on those days.
Stock's been down on average 10%.
Maybe it doesn't happen this time.
Yeah.
Maybe, just to think counterintuitively, everyone wants to get out ahead of the quarter. It's always bad. You know, he's
yeah, but if they're honest, Danny,
I'm not saying
if they're honest about Q2, this is really important. Yeah. People like get this all the time. We are 1 month into Q2.
It's a disaster.
By the time they report, they have good visibility. China's a disaster. Okay. Like China's a flat-out disaster. Europe's a disaster. The rate environment's a disaster. The sentiment around the quality of the cars right now.
The Cybertrucks are a disaster.
Yeah. So, all right, let's move on.
All right, move on.
We got plenty of time.
That was Noriel Rubini disaster.
All right. Let's look at two names because I want to try to get a couple questions here. Netflix after the close tonight, 8.5% implied move. 3 months ago, Carter, you were on Market Call and you said to us, with the stock at these levels, after the gap that it had in the prior quarter, it's most likely going to have another gap if the company is able to put up a good quarter and a good guide. And it did just that. Mm-hmm. And then it never looked back for the most part here. It's kind of lost a bit of momentum. You see how far it's come. Thoughts here on just the technical setup.
Right. So gaps typically come in twos or threes, and you see the quarterly gap and then the second quarterly gap. The question is, do we get a third, or is it actually the opposite? It gaps down. So while the stock has stalled day to day, and you can see that, its relative performance is very, very good because the market is coming off fairly aggressively. So if a relative strength line is making new day-to-day highs. But here's a chart that puts all of it in perspective, right? And the plunge, the recovery. Let's draw some lines. We know we have ascended in this mathematically. I didn't make those lines. They are mathematically parallel lines. And we blew out through the top of this. The question is, do we check back to the upper band or do we actually stretch to the high? Next chart, that high, let's flash that for fun. That high is the question. Does the stock ultimately climb back there? That's my guess. And so final chart, I put some green arrows. I think we ultimately will approach that high.
It's interesting. I've never been short this stock because it's a macro theme. Macro theme. Yeah. I was just at a sports media conference this morning and Tyson and Jake Paul are fighting on July 20th.
Dallas.
And it's Netflix.
Yeah.
And that's a live sports. Yeah. And I'm not saying that, listen, that's a one-off event. But you think about how this thing has evolved.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So anyway, I don't even know what the valuation
is. Well, here's the thing. Let's talk about it. Now, GAAP earnings for this year expect to be up 43%. It's trading at 35 times. Next year, 23% expected EPS growth, trading at about 29 times. Revenue growth expected to be about 14% this year, 12% next. It's been improving margins. They're just putting through a new price increase. That's just pure margin when they do that. The one thing I'm going to say, though, so 41.5% gross margins last year, 43%. 0.74 expected this year, 45.5% the following year. So it's a good story. The only thing I'm going to say about this, I don't really have a great feeling on this, is that there's been a lot of volatility around those subscriber numbers and where they come from and where the good subscribers are coming from. So if the consumer in the U.S. has been trading down, and we've heard that a little bit, maybe there is a little bit of pushback. Maybe the writer's strike, okay? But like, there weren't enough really interesting titles. Maybe that's one of the reasons why they're going into some of this live stuff. I don't know, and I don't really have a great feel on it. And sometimes what I do during earnings season, especially in some early names in a sector, I like to see what they put up and how the market reacts to it, no different than Taiwan Semi. Because if you just looked at that in the vacuum, you would have said that's really good, and it wasn't. And let's see how quickly Taiwan Semi can regain some of that ground, or if it continues to the downside.
You are coming up on the anniversary of the strike, or not the anniversary, but the leading up to the kind of the strike that occurred. That they have put new content on. Again, I don't want to go down the Netflix rabbit hole. I will tell you that I just went back to Netflix last week because I wanted to watch The Gentlemen, and it was worth it for me. So I'm paying $21 again, like schmuck. Meanwhile, my whole family was sharing the password a year ago. I think they're doing something right.
That helped. Yeah.
I think it was brilliant. Yeah. The two major things they did was the disc business went away, the mail-in, and then this, and it's worked for them. So I'll be curious, but it's amazing, Dan. You talk about Tesla, and then you talk about Netflix.
Yeah.
And your whole mindset changes in terms of a great business model, right, that can evolve. And yes, there'll be turbulent times, but you still feel okay. To one that is really at risk in terms of the business model in near term. Anyway, enough of that. Yeah. But it really is a battle of two.
All right,
interesting that you've never been short, because it's a dangerous, even though it had that plunge. I my hunch is to play on the long side
here. All right. Okay. All right. So let's look at Procter & Gamble tomorrow before the opening. Generally not a huge mover on earnings, 3% implied move in either direction. We just threw one of our charts up here. We saw as yields started moving higher, staples started moving lower. We know that relationship. Consolidating a little bit after that move lower from a new 52-week high. I'm not sure if that's an all-time high. I'm sure your charts will kind of work us through that. Carter, what are you seeing in the Procter?
Can I guess? Before he says,
because yeah, go ahead, do. Like back in the day, yeah,
he likes it. It's if you're long, stay long. If you're short, you probably cover pair of twos with a long bias. That's a pair of twos with a long bias.
Especially because you think yields are going lower. Does that make sense?
It is a pair of two. So the trick is, and Danny's got that right. Meaning, look, if you didn't, you have to always remove your bias. So if it didn't say Procter and Gamble upper left, and it was just those white lines, you'd be like, what the hell is this thing?
Yeah.
Wandering across the screen, up, down, up, down. That's what a pair of twos is. There's no reference point. Is it about to break out? Is it about to bounce off a moving average? Is it basing and bottoming after a massive decline? It's none of the above. So let's look at some charts. I think I've got two. And look, there you have it. I put three arrows, meaning it's going to pop a little bit on its earnings. It's going to drop a little bit. But there's nothing about that setup, at least to my eye, by my work, that suggests that one should be directional here. And if we look at this same chart, but we pull it back, and there you have it, right? So a stock that hasn't been able to make a new all-time high since its 2021 high, and is just meandering within a range. Obviously, a bulletproof business that will be around forever, a very low beta, typically pays a higher yield on the market. But is there anything chart-wise to suggest we've got to get out here and buy this thing? We've got to get out here and short this thing. Nothing by my work.
Sounds like no. Okay. Let's take a few questions here before we get out of here. I appreciate you guys going extra innings with us here. Okay. This is from Sanjeev V. Hi, Carter. Can you please comment on IWM? That would be the ETF that tracks the Russell 2000. Let's give Carter a second here
to pull up the chart.
We'll do it real time. Amanda's going to pull it up, and we're going to do it all together here, people.
Right. So there's two circumstances in a sort of conflict. This is as seen here, as opposed to that last chart, which was wandering across the screen. This has made a new intermediate high, and now it has checked back, and it's getting down to a level where one might say, hey, this has bounce potential. But that's this chart. Mm-hmm. Pull this back to a 5-year, and this will tell the true story of what this is. And let's wait till that comes up. If we see a 5-year chart, what you're going to see is the biggest pair of twos you ever saw, right?
Yeah, so, hard four.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, it's been in that big consolidation between what 160 and 200 or so. That was that new intermediate sort of high. A lot of folks were saying, well, if the broader market is broadening, right, the Russell and small caps, if they could pull that up.
5-year.
Somebody was having lunch or something like that.
There we go. So what about that? If that was a biotech stock, if that was a semi stock, if that was a currency or commodity, if we just you have to suspend always and forever what you might know or think you know about the Russell and say, what about that circumstance pictorially says it's a buy or sell? Not much, at least to my eye.
Danny, thoughts on small caps here? Just fundamentally, you mentioned this point before, you know, the cost of capital.
They're more interest rate sensitive by nature. Just because they're smaller, they're more dependent on financial markets for growth. That's it. It's that simple.
Do you ever, when you get bullish, think, buy? Sorry. Or bearish. Is the Russell, the IWM, is that a vehicle?
It's for beta. It's express? The higher
beta. Okay.
For sure.
All right. Let's look at some, let's get something else here. This is from Griffin Keenan.
GK.
Question, what is Danny's view on iShares mortgage-backed securities, the MBS ETF? The ticker is MBB. And maybe just if you want to start talking about, they'll pull it up, MBB, a little bit, thoughts on the mortgage environment. What, we had a 30-year mortgage just get back above 7% or so. We've had some earnings from some of the builders. Look at that thing right there through the moving average.
And basically mortgage spreads in general, the price of mortgages, again, with QT starting to be tapered, remember, I think it's $35 billion roughly. Of mortgage backed securities per month that are, you know, not being quote reinvested, just letting run off. So again, could they get a bounce? Sure. But I think part of this is related to 10-year yields to a degree and 30-year yields. And part of it's related to what the Fed has been doing, Treasury's been unloading. These things moved. If you go back to that, well, not back there, if you go to 2000, when the Fed first started leaking that they were going to late 2021, they were going to start
November.
Right. November 2021, the traders, rightfully so, got ahead of it. It wasn't inside information. They said, basically, we're going to start. That was when you first, and we've yet to ever recover from that move. So I think when the Fed does start cutting, eventually you certainly get a bounce. But so I'm not, to me, I'd probably hold it here. Certainly wouldn't want to sell down here. And you're still at.
All right, really quickly, let's hit Roha Buckingham. If Japan has a currency crisis, how far could this market drop? What do you guys want to look at it through the lens of the DXJ? Would that make some sense? That's a hedged.
JPY, or are you saying JPY? What is the impact on the, I on think the markets?
I think equities.
Right. How far could their market drop?
Their market.
Carter, I'll let you go first.
Well, we know that the Nikkei just touched its all-time high. And so could this prospectively be one of the most epic double tops of all time? There is that possibility. I don't know if we can pull up a Nikkei chart and do it 30 years, but you'll see that there. But if not, I mean, speculating how far a plunge, a real crisis, I mean, 20, 30%. But take a look at the Nikkei. Perhaps we can see this here. We might be able to go back.
Go back to 1990 if you can. But
And you'll see the all-time high. And we just touched it.
We did.
I might not go that.
You know what else touched the same exact level when the Nikkei, the yen? 153 was the exact price in 1990. So there's a reason for that. There's a fundamental reason.
And the yen is pushing higher on the charts, which is obviously weaker.
So the answer is, there you go.
So there we went literally to
40,000.
And remember, they call it the land of the rising sun.
Yeah.
America, it will never be able to recover compared to Japan. They acquired great assets like Pebble Beach. They acquired Rockefeller Center. Japan is taking over, of course. When you start to hear things like that, run the other way. It was the peak, and look how long it took to get back.
So the reason it's important is because, again, central bank experiments have gone wrong. Their debt to GDP is so high. Forget about it. Back then it was 130, 140. They're 250, 260. We were 67. Sorry, they were 67, went there. We were 67. Now we're 130. It matters. It matters because of what it can exacerbate. So you have to pay attention to this, quote, carry trade that's been going on. And Peter Buchvar was just on.
He was on Monday
talking about
us.
This exact thing.
Well, we'll talk about it too. So also, Danny and I pretty soon are going to sit down with Cameron Dawson from New Edge. And we're going to talk a little bit. This is on the tape podcast. We'll drop tomorrow morning. Let's just do two more here before we get out of here. KS asks, please get Carter's take on Apple. That would be your technical take there, Carter.
Yeah. Don't know anything about it except I got one in my pocket. So that's that part.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
But can I guess again? What? I love this. This is, I feel like we're back. Can I guess again? We see it. I have to look at it first.
Well, look, this is
go ahead.
The real standout issue here. We don't even need to try. Everyone has it in their mind's eye. But how poor the relative performance is compared to
that's the 1 year. Look at that.
And the real risk here is that
now
this breaks
5 year.
That this breaks these intermediate lows. And what makes it even worse is that it tried to pop just a few days ago. Right now, that's a log chart, so that mutes to some extent. But if we did it arithmetic, you'll see the real risk here that this undercuts these intermediate lows and has a quick downdraft. And you also have the double top, which is couldn't make an absolute high. The relative performance is now almost at a two and a half year low to the queues, not good. And this is probably, or still is, the most widely owned security in the world.
Yeah. All right. And then let's do, this is a good one for you, Danny. This is from Tyler. Any tips on not doing emotional trading after a big miss? I'm new to trading. So I'm assuming he's saying after a big miss on earnings, do you get a big gap lower, you know, reaction to that sort of thing? What is your default? Some people say, what you say this all the time, first loss, best loss, that sort of thing.
That's one of the best rules there is.
Yeah. Yeah, the reason that you owned it, if that reason is no longer exists or the thesis changes, you sell it. The market's pretty efficient. Mm-hmm. You're not going to, the market's going to be priced correctly the next morning. So by selling it, you're not necessarily getting ahead of anything potentially, right? Mm-hmm. And if you bought it for a reason, it's not. So if it's a quality company that doesn't trade on multiple of revenue, mm-hmm. that has a dividend yield per se, like a Procter & Gamble or something, and there's a miss, and I think you just, you know, you hold things that, you know.
So Carter will say this, and I'm just speak for you again. You know who you are in the market. What mm-hmm. is your time horizon, right? Because even great companies have foul ups. You know what I mean? Like one.
But getting paid to wait, getting a dividend yield of 5% or something on a Walgreens Boots, right? Which is a terrible looking chart at this point. Terrible. But you know, terrible. They cut their dividend. It's almost back to the same dividend yield it was before they cut the dividend last time. We bring that chart up. My point is, unless you think they're going out of business, let's they're repaying debt on their balance sheet and so forth. So, oof. Carter, help me out with that one. Right. Anyway, so my point is, I wouldn't sell that here only because if you're comfortable with the fundamentals and you know what's happening, you know, then so again, I think it's very company.
Well, I think specific. He's also talking about like a big gap, you know, in those days where you get those sorts of things.
Right. I mean, and look, the yield, I mean, think about like an AT&T or Verizon, obviously horrific long term, but they're bonds. I mean, they're constantly paying, Philip Morris paying you 7 to 9% every year. It really doesn't matter what the stock does. If you can come to a judgment they will not go out of business, then you don't care what it does. They're sending you that coupon. That's a different game altogether.
Yep. Okay, people.
Never get emotional about stocks, bud.
Yeah, Wall Street. All right. We covered a lot of ground today. I really appreciate you both being here in the studio. And it was fun to hear a little bit of your back and forth, like you probably had back in the day a little bit. So
we're just missing some scotch, Carter.
Yeah. Well, what do you think's in here?
Well, we always did our things after market hours.
That's right. Always.
Okay. Just to be clear, from a compliance perspective.
All right, people. Well, that was a lot of fun. Have a great long weekend. We will be back with Guy Adami on Monday, tomorrow morning in the year. On the tape podcast feed, just go subscribe to it, people. That's the easiest way to get it to your smartphone. We're going to be with Cameron Dawson, so check that out. We hope you all have a great weekend, and thank you guys for being here.